Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark LaLiberty, a senior security analyst at WatchGuard Threat Lab. And once again, this week, I will be joined by WatchGuard's CTO, Corey Nachreiner. Each week on the podcast, we will analyze the methods and techniques behind the latest hacks, attacks, and breaches. We'll tell you what happened, how the bad guys did it, and how to protect your business, employees, and customers. In episode 2, and because the universe has a great sense of humor, just after digging into cryptocurrency in episode 1, we get a major hack of a cryptocurrency exchange and crypto mining malware on Amazon TV and Fire Sticks. And I swear I had nothing to do with either of these. Later in this episode, we'll discuss the Internet of Things. We're surrounded by internet-connected and, for the large part, horribly insecure devices that have powered record-breaking botnet attacks. How is this happening, and how can you prevent your fridges and coffee pots from being drafted into the botnet army? That and more on today's episode. Let's start the show. First thing I want to talk about is actually a recently discovered cryptocurrency mining malware found on Amazon Fire Sticks. Have you heard about this one, Corey?
Absolutely. Technically, Fire TV, which it has many appliances, including the Fire Stick. So yeah, definitely saw about that. I even saw a couple of headlines suggesting that it was crypto miner for the Fire Stick, or subtly making it seem like it was for the Fire Stick, which is probably not true in this case, right?
No, in this one, it looks like it's actually Android-specific malware that just so happens to be hitting Android-based IoT devices like the Amazon Fire TV.
Yeah, exactly.
And in this case, it looks like the primary infection method requires the user to enable something called ADB debugging.
Yeah, dev mode. Basically, Fire Stick has a dev mode. And this is not only just a Android-based crypto miner. It's a well-known one. ADB miner, I think it's called. Yep. It's not new. It's been out for quite a long time, affecting Android devices around the world. But like any other Android device, if you enable sideloading, which I assume is one of the things dev mode does, allows you to load unsanctioned third-party applications.
Yep, there's even that little checkbox. Do you want to allow installing untrusted applications on your device, which
yeah, exactly.
I'm sure some people have ticked sometimes.
By the way, I tick it sometimes too. If you're a developer, I mean, you kind of have to. I mean, that's why they call it development mode. If I want to write my own Android code, which you can, I need to do that while I'm beta testing before I get it into, in this case, Amazon's marketplace, or it could be Google for Android.
There's reasons to do it. Yeah, like if you want to get into Android's specific customability options that you see a lot, as opposed to like Apple's closed ecosystem, right?
Exactly. Now, the thing is, I think a lot of Fire TV people, there's also kind of shady reasons to do it. I think one reason you might want to sideload apps specifically on a Fire TV is maybe streaming piracy things that you can find in Android third-party marketplaces, but that would require this.
Really? That sounds awful. Tell me more about those. Where could I find them?
Give me a URL for research purposes, please.
Yeah, and this isn't the first time we've seen people getting bit by sideloaded applications either.
Oh, for sure.
I remember when Pokemon Go first came out, when it was only available in certain regions, other regions would try and download it via unofficial sources.
Exactly.
And people were hiding things like adware in it, or even ransomware at a few occasions as well.
Yep. It's not that hard to repackage an ADB file. So this is very common. I think really the funny thing is, while Fire TV, Amazon was in the headlines, this really is just Android malware. And I think later in this episode, we'll talk a lot about IoT, which, you know, a Fire Stick or Android TV is. But one of the things we'll talk about is the difference between IoT devices that kind of use off-the-shelf operating systems versus ones that are proprietary, and kind of a difference in security risk there. And to me, this just proves that, you know, some IoT devices are literally just like other computing devices with the same operating system, and they'll have the exact same vulnerabilities and succumb to the exact same malware.
Yep. Now, the somewhat good news, I guess you could call it, is that it's pretty easy to tell when you've become infected by this, because it basically renders your Fire TV unusable, because this malware is actually using up all of the processing resources in order to earn cryptocurrency, right?
Yeah, personally, I don't use Amazon for my streaming, but I hear that the actual thing this does, the TV streaming, doesn't work if this is installed because it's just using so much of the CPU, can't probably decompress videos. So probably easy to figure out if your Fire TV has this.
Yep, and there are other tools you can use to try and find it. In some cases, I heard recommendations of something called Total Commander, trying to find hidden processes. The application itself, the name is just Test. So yeah. If you see an application called Test running on your device, you are probably a victim of this.
Although I think you and I have talked about the irony of the fact that you kind of have to sideload non-standard Fire TV apps in order to find this.
Use an app to find your bad app.
And the truth is, from what I've heard, if they rename this and stuff, you know, Total Commander is something that can help you find processes. But I think for the normal everyday consumer, the best advice, it does have some work behind it, is simply to reset your Fire TV, Amazon Fire TV to factory standard. And the downside of that, your settings are going to change again. Exactly. All that stuff you had to do to set it up and get it working. And I don't know if you can add media to the Fire TV because I don't add it, but if it might get rid of any media if you can upload it to some of the TVs.
Certainly annoying. So be on the lookout for that one. In our next news topic, though, there is another very major cryptocurrency exchange that was hacked recently. A South Korean-based one. They lost $31 million worth of cryptocurrency. The exchange was Bithum, and this isn't the first time we've seen a specifically South Korean exchange hit.
I think it's like the second time in a week, or at least in the year. Yeah. There's one in January, too, so there's been a number of South Korean.
January was a CoinCheck, a Japanese-based one. They lost $350 million worth of cryptocurrency, but just I think 2 weeks ago now, it was CoinRail, which was a South Korean-based one that got hit. They lost $40 million. Yeah. So it seems like exchanges are becoming major targets for cyber criminals trying to earn some money.
By the way, Mark, when I'm blabbing really fast, I'm sometimes kind of inexact. And we talk a lot in our first cryptocurrency episode about wallets, your cryptocurrency wallet. And we talked about maybe your personal one, the offline one, which could be software on your computer or a USB key or something like that. But the truth is, you might have lots of wallets involved with your cryptocurrency. There could be an online wallet that's different, and an exchange. What is an exchange in reference to wallet? While it's not an exchange, it's meant to, I think, to do transactions, which you can tell us a bit about. There is a wallet associated with it as well.
Yeah. So in terms of cryptocurrency, a wallet simply is a public key and a private key. Cryptocurrency and blockchain tech rely on this asymmetric encryption and hashing in order to secure transactions. So when you create a wallet, you generally have to use random mouse movements or type in random words, and it'll generate a random key. And that public key is your wallet address. People can send transactions to that public address. And then your private key lets you sign transactions to then send funds somewhere else, withdraw them, whatever. So on your computer, if you have a wallet, you have a public key and a private key and an application that wraps around that that lets you use that private key to send funds elsewhere. When you sign up for an exchange, like with Coinbase, for example, they automatically generate a public and private key for you, but you never get that private key. Instead, you just have actions you can take through their interface, such as transferring funds from your account with Coinbase down to your own public address, your own wallet that you store somewhere, or withdraw funds where they will take care of transferring it to their own account and then give you cash. You do typically have, if you are interfacing with a cryptocurrency, more than one wallet. And I would actually go so far as to recommend you should always have more than one wallet. A very common mistake people make is they'll say, oh, I want to buy some Bitcoin. So they'll go to Coinbase, sign up for an account.
Which is an exchange, technically.
Which is an exchange.
You're going there to make a transaction of buying stuff.
Converting
but when you
US
do it, you have it in
it.
Your temporary exchange wallet so you can receive it in the first place.
And the problem is a lot of people don't treat that as a temporary exchange wallet. They will store their $1,000, $10,000, whatever worth of
Bitcoin.
Yeah,
my grandma Mel in Canada, who decided she wanted a little bit of Bitcoin, would look up, oh, I got to go to Coinbase and do this, voila, I now have one Ethereum in my Coinbase wallet, I'm done.
Yep. Well, if she went to go buy Bitcoin and then she ended up with Ethereum, she has other problems.
I should think about that way. It could happen though, Grandma Mel.
But exactly, yeah. So they'll end up with potentially huge amounts of money in terms of virtual currency in this wallet where they don't necessarily have control over the private key. So if a bad actor goes in and hacks Coinbase and somehow dumps the database or wherever they store these private keys, if they're not offline at the company, they could have access to all your funds and drain them out. That's what we are seeing with some of these hacks against
exchanges. So let me throw an analogy at you and see if it works for you. So really, in real life, say I have $1 million. I have $1 million in cash. You know, I would put that, you know, one thing I could do is I could keep that in my own safe, in my own house. In a, let's imagine there's a wallet I can put $1 million into, or maybe there's a $1 million bill one day. That would literally be one form of wallet. Another thing I could do that, because I don't, you know, maybe having $1 million in cash lying around my house isn't good, and I want to make transactions or wire transfers, I could also take some of that $1 million and put it in a bank account.
Yep.
And then I could also maybe say I want to go to a stock exchange or a broker. I could put some of my bank money into another wallet that they use to make stock purchases or transfer the funds into different mediums. So that analogy, you know, the money you have at home, the hard cold cash, that's the kind of stuff where you've either, you know, printed out the QR code or the actual private keys for your personal wallet, or maybe it's a hardware wallet you have on a USB stick. Then there's this concept of online wallets. There are providers that they're not an exchange, but they're an online wallet. That might be a bank. You have a bank account just because it's convenient to have it more online and to make transactions. And then the exchange, you know, could be related to the bank, but that could be like a finance house or stock broker
account.
And you still have to move stuff to that brokerage account too. And the point is, you don't, you know, the brokerage account, you're probably not using every single day. So you don't want to leave your $1 million up there. Maybe the analogy doesn't work in that today we leave most of our money in the bank, but let's assume our home, our hardware wallet is the most secure place.
Under the mattress. Our cold storage is under the mattress.
There we go. Storage is under the mattress. Does that kind of work out?
Yeah, that does. And really what it comes down to is with these exchanges, there's the potential that because your money isn't in your control, someone else could go in there and steal it more easily. Now, that isn't to say they are inherently insecure. They do generally do a great job of protecting your money.
In fact, they tend to probably understand how to protect it more than Grandma Mel, so they could do a better job. Grandma Mel may forget her private key and never get her money back.
Exactly. But mistakes do happen, as we know, especially in technology. So there's the greater chance of it getting drained there than if your private key is just on a piece of paper stored in a safe or behind a picture frame or something. So in this case, though, it was, what, $31 million that were drained?
This was Korea, Mark. It's 35 million won.
Okay. I'm very sorry.
The equivalent of $31 million.
I forgot to use Google money translation or whatever it is this time. There haven't been very many details released in exactly how this one was carried out. But there was, back in January, the same exchange actually told a news outlet that they were suspecting that North Korea, for example, might be trying to hack them and steal money out of their accounts. There was September of last year, FireEye, a very famous and well-known security organization, they actually released a report claiming that they had evidence that North Korea was conducting attacks against three major unnamed South Korean exchanges. So it seems like this might be a continuation of some trends that we have seen recently with North Korea's involvement in cryptocurrency.
Yeah, possibly for sure. Hard to you know, attribute it for sure, but potentially likely.
It makes sense.
Yeah. And by the way, I think BitThumb has seen this coming, and they've reported that they've been seeing increased amounts of unauthorized access attempts before this happened quite a bit. And they're trying to make their security more robust from the sounds of it.
And to their credit, too, they've claimed they're going to basically pay out of their own wallet in order to cover all this, which is very commendable for them, because you could imagine other companies would just fold.
So what are there any practical takeaways here? I really think it probably is in, and you can give me your views, but in the distribution of where you have multiple wallets. You got to realize what you use an exchange for, what you might use an online wallet for versus what you should do to keep the Bitcoin that you're just holding, or the cryptocurrency, whatever it is that you're just holding on to. So any practical tips on distributing your funds?
So I would say money that you are going to be using, cryptocurrency that you just bought or you're going to try and sell or use for something else, an exchange is great. In fact, you generally need one in order to convert cryptocurrency into money or another currency. So that's your very temporary storage only. Put it in there immediately before sending a transaction to send it somewhere else.
But you shouldn't be leaving that $1,000 worth of Ethereum there, Ether.
Your retirement savings, which I hope it isn't your, the entirety of your retirement savings, but
we already talked about investing in cryptocurrency.
Your large amounts of cryptocurrency, if you have it, that's where you use a cold wallet. So print out a QR code. There's applications out there. MyEtherWallet.org is a great company that can help you walk through setting up a cold storage account, where this wallet has never touched a computer that has touched the internet, so it is generally safe. You can still have access to the public key, so you can transfer funds to it, but in order to get money out, someone has to go find wherever you've hidden this QR code or the printout of some words that can be converted back into the private key.
Do you have any thoughts on online wallets? Like, the one place that my analogy breaks down is, today we put a decent amount of money in banks, but I personally am not sure you need a online wallet. I think it's good enough to have cold storage and then just, you know, send some of the currency to the exchange when you need to use it. But is there an argument for having that third entity and a more medium kind of a hot online wallet that you might use on a more weekly or monthly basis?
I'd say yes. So I actually use a browser plugin that's pretty popular called MetaMask, where I have another wallet in there. It's a third wallet where I store some amount of Ethereum, in my case, an amount where if it were to get breached through something, I wouldn't lose my shirt over it. I'd still be a little upset, but it's where I use my day-to-day money. So like, if I'm going to go buy another CryptoKitty or something, I can just use that wallet instead of having to go dig out my private key, re-enter it, turn it back into a key, and then try and transfer that way. So small amounts in there, big amounts in your offline one, and then when you're going to make a transaction.
So I'll make it totally concrete. If you have $1 million worth of cryptocurrency, you probably keep $950,000 in the mattress under your bed, which is printed, or the hardware wallet. You might keep,
50 bucks in your back pocket.
50K online, or I'm sorry, 40... 45K, wow, big purchases. Maybe it's 49.9K on an online wallet, which is stuff you're just paying week to week, month to month. And then you only literally put the thousand or so dollars left, or hundred or so dollars left, in the exchange immediately when you need it.
Yep.
When you need to do some transaction.
I would say that is very fair.
Cool.
So with that, let's go ahead and move on to our next discussion, which is going to be about the Internet of Things. I'm here with Corey again, and today we are going to be talking about the Internet of Things, or IoT.
Gotta love those sexy marketing buzzwords.
All right, pop, Corey, let's go through the history of IoT first.
Absolutely.
You want to start out?
IoT is not a new thing. I mean, that's the biggest thing. IoT, I feel like I don't know how old the term was, but it's like the 2010s.
Late 2000s, I think. Yeah. Or 2008 is like the first time IoT really took off as a term.
But it's existed forever. I mean, my favorite example was, I remember when some of the early, by the way, even networking isn't just TCP/IP, Internet, Ethernet. We had Token Ring way back in my day when I was a youngin. and we had printers on networks back then. So really, IoT, the definition obviously is any, I kind of say, non-traditional computer device, anything that doesn't really look like a traditional computer, but it's on a network. That's IoT, right? To some extent. Printers were that way a long time ago. Bad guys found ways to hack the, you know, some of the FTP servers running on an HP printer that had the ability to share documents over a network. And I used to find hidden directories with wares, pirated software file servers, running on these printers.
You never downloaded any of that, right?
Yeah, that's definitely not the reason I found them. It wasn't because
no,
I was
research purposes.
Remotely finding them or anything. But I found them in some way. And then you think it's some tiny little office in Arkansas has a little printer sitting there, and they have no freaking clue it has a pirate server, FTP server, running on it. This happened way before the term IoT came out. So excuse me if I'm a little skeptical about the whole term IoT. That said, the risk of this problem is very, very true and worth talking about.
Yeah. So what are some of those risks then, do you think?
Well, I think the main risk is pretty obvious. I mean, these devices are just computers. You know, anything that connects to a I guess the main thing is the internet. So it has to connect to the internet, which today means it has to speak TCP/IP. But if it does that, it's a hardware device that runs software. And I think if you look at whatever security vulnerability they are, at least the technical ones, they're always, you know, a misconfiguration or a software vulnerability in the software or the hardware device. So it doesn't matter if it's a computer or if it's a coffee maker, it can have a software flaw that people can take advantage of.
And one of the big misconceptions that we need to clear up with that specifically is just because it's a coffee maker doesn't mean the attacker is going to get something of use off the coffee maker. They don't care to know how dark your roast was this morning. They want to use that as that coffee maker as a method to launch further attacks.
Yeah, and that's a good point. While I make fun of the IoT term, people shouldn't minimize the threat of this. Like we joke all the time, who cares about your wireless egg timer or your refrigerator or your TV? Are they going to show you nude pictures on your smart TV? Yes, not many people. That would be irritating, by the way. For most people, it'd be irritating, yeah. By the way.
Let's say irritating.
But like you say, the issue isn't whether or not the device is particularly useful as a device. It's more about the place that lives on your network. If that is the weakest link in your network, that could become a bastion host or, you know, the place you start to attack the rest of the internal network, and you start to pivot into the lateral movement. So every single device connected to your network, no matter its specific value, is important to secure for that reason.
Yeah, and it's not even just attacking your networks. One of the biggest issues with IoT is attacking other people's networks.
Oh yeah, I mean, we know resource, maybe we'll get into that later, but compute resource can be used maliciously in other attacks for sure.
Yeah, I mean, the greatest example of this was it all the way back in like 2016 now?
Yes, it's been a while.
Forever ago, the Mirai botnet was the first big attack we saw with IoT that really show the true power of these devices that, I mean, they might just be a little camera or a DVR somewhere, but when you add all them together, they have record-breaking potential power in the form of denial of service attacks.
They're on the internet and they send traffic. So if you get 500,000 of them, that's a whole heck of a lot of traffic. I think Mirai specifically, if I remember right, it's something like 650 or 620 some kilobits per second for the Krebs attack against that security blogger.
So Mirai was believed to be responsible for three major denial of service attacks. One against
at least.
Security
yeah.
journalist Brian Krebs. Took down his blog with 660 something
around there
gigabits per second of traffic, which is just an insane amount of traffic. And then
it got
just
bigger though, right?
Just a week later, it took down a French web host
OVH
with 1.1 terabits per second, which is the first time we saw a denial service attack across the terabit range. And then a little bit after that, it was Dyn, a DNS hosting provider, which they got hit with 1.2 terabits per second, and that took down their DNS hosting service, which took down a lot of websites that rely on that hosting. Like, do you remember that day? I remember. It took down GitHub and Reddit and Twitter, so all my productivity
and
that
a lot
day was
of
gone. I mean,
oh wait, all your productivity increased if I remember correctly. But it was in the East Coast, I think, primarily at a certain early time. But yeah, it knocked them down for sure. And I think, by the way, there's a lot of Mirai copycats. I think Reaper is doing the same thing. But as you say, that's just one of the DDoS attacks. I mean, essentially, you're a botnet. It doesn't matter if it's an IoT device or a computer. You're just stealing other people's computer for resource. We're just scratching the surface with DDoS. I mean, old school traditional botnets could use that same resource for clickjacking, for ad fraud, to become proxy services, to hide other attacks by just pushing them through these. So I expect IoT botnets to start monetizing and using all those attacks. I think there's some IoT botnets that have started spamming recently too, which is another thing you can use computer, you know, hijack computer for, sending malicious email.
Yeah, or proxying them to hide their source, which really does quite a bit in terms of getting past traditional anti-spam services. If you can make it come from a fresh IP address that hasn't sent spam before, it's less likely to be picked up as spam.
It's not on the blacklist.
Exactly. We're also starting to finally see IoT devices being used for cryptocurrency mining, for example, where, I mean, my tiny little camera above my porch back at home doesn't have a whole lot of computing power, but if it can do
you know, a tenth of a cent a day, and the attacker can get 10,000 of them, it's quite a bit of money every day that they're able to mine.
It's all about distribution, not really one resource's power.
Exactly.
So absolutely.
And then,
go for it.
I was going to say another really novel type of issue with IoT is when they're used in traditionally non-network connected areas, just as a novel concept. And one of the examples that's a really great slash terrible example for this is something called Cloud Pets. If you're not familiar with Cloud Pets, it's a teddy bear that is internet connected, and it allows a parent and a child to communicate with each other through the bear and an app on their smartphone. And so the parent can record a message, it gets sent to Cloud Pets' cloud, the Cloud Pet itself brings down the message and then plays it back for the kid. Cloud Pets was just recently taken off the Amazon store because of a huge number of vulnerabilities in the bear itself and the platform it relied on. For example, attackers were able to find every single message ever recorded from Cloud Pets' cloud, which, I mean, communications between parents and kids, it's not generally something you want to have bad guys have access to. Even worse, I might say, is there are still unpatched vulnerabilities on the teddy bear itself that could allow any bad guy in Bluetooth range, which if you have a large enough antenna, doesn't even have
that
to be right outside your house.
Last time I saw Bluetooth sniping.
Anyone in Bluetooth range of the bear to basically send whatever message they want. So you can have some creep a mile away sending messages to your kids, and that's
having a little teddy bear whispering mean things to your kid in the middle of the night.
It's terrifying. So they were actually just taken off Amazon.com, but that shows like some more of these non-traditional attack surfaces for IoT devices that are now a problem because they're being connected to networks.
Yeah. And by the way, I think that I mentioned that they're just computers. And really, I think all of the points you made are an example of that. I mean, the teddy bear was just a computer that connected to a cloud backend and played WAV files or whatever,
yep.
Right? But I do think the one thing that's not talked about a lot is I think there's a range of riskiness in IoT devices. And the way I usually divide it is there's some IoT devices that literally use off-the-shelf operating systems. You know, the most common one is Linux. Open source to many people means free, even though that's not always the case. But Linux is definitely in IoT devices, sometimes embedded Windows. But then there's another class of IoT systems that are very proprietary. I mean, some developer created a purpose-driven device, a device that has specific purposes, and they made custom code just to do that. And yes, it can still speak to the internet, so obviously it has traditional networking capability. It's still a computer running code and can have flaws. It's created for a single reason. And I think there's a big range of potential risk difference between those off-the-shelf embedded operating systems versus the proprietary ones. That's not to say that a custom proprietary IoT device is totally secure and perfect.
It can still give up your sensitive data.
Yeah, while it might be a black box operating system, there may be a software vulnerability or a coding mistake in there that some guy can do something against.
It could suffer a buffer
overflow. It still has a CPU running things and putting it in memory. Could have clear text communication. But the issue I think that's really big right now is the fact that most of the IoT, that the consumer-based IoT that's just flooding the market right now from, you know, wherever it's manufactured, is just grabbing off-the-shelf Linux packages.
Take Linux, throw BusyBox on it, ship it out the door.
Bam, there you go. And it's because it has a way to create a web UI to make some sort of management interface. It has remote access for the developers that have to troubleshoot it with, I don't know, SSH. But the problem is they just, you know, take it off the shelf, Linux off the shelf, and they don't secure any of this because they have to sell this product for $20 on Amazon. They're not spending a lot of time paying attention to all these details. So I think it's resulted in a flood of devices that are literally just like your traditional Linux computer. But worse yet, I mean, a traditional Linux computer can be secured, and most distros have updated some of their hardening and security practices to be really secure out of the box. But these to me feel like circa 2000s type vulnerabilities that we're seeing things in webcams and network storage devices and things like that.
Plus, I sometimes hate to generalize, but generally if you're going to be deploying Linux, like an actual Linux computer, you are a computer person, which means that you have at least some desire to keep it a little more secure. Maybe you'll install your security patches once every other month, hopefully once every month. But if you're buying an IoT device, which is still running Linux, for example, and you're my mom, she's not a computer person, she's not going to keep it updated, even if it had a way to be updated for security flaws.
I think another way to say this is Linux is generally very open to allow you to configure it to do anything you want, because it's intended for power users to tweak everything they want to. So when you sell it to a grandma that's not used to all that power, she can shoot herself in the foot.
Exactly. Yes, that is a much more succinct way of putting it.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. So I think there's a lot of problems with IoT security, which we'll talk about, but right now I think that's the biggest problem. And the sad thing is I think it's more a market dynamics problem, because until we're willing to spend money to get the manufacturers to be able to invest more in the cost of these products, by cost I mean they need to take the time to secure it, which means it might have to cost a little bit more because they invest their time. And until we pay for that by paying a higher price for a more secure device, this problem's going to continue.
But until then, there's still the issue that they just want something that works and something is cheap, which means the manufacturers need to put out something quickly to beat the market or at least join the market, and it needs to be competitively priced. And every extra day or hour that you spend on adding security to your development team is less money that you're making on the back end, and if there's no incentive, why do it?
Yeah.
So I really think that we are close to having incentive from consumers in one way or another. The Mirai botnet was bad when it happened, and especially the attack against Dyne, where it took down a lot of popular websites, it got a lot of press. And so if we have another even larger scale attack in the future, it's going to finally convince consumers that, hey, there's this issue, or even IT administrators that deploy it in their company, hey, maybe we got to start protecting these devices a little bit better on our network. Or companies going, hey, they're not doing anything, maybe we got to start adding regulations to force them to secure them more.
And I think that's the way it's going to happen. I think at this point, like you say, consumers, until it kicks them in the face, are slow to move. But as more Mirais happen, it's going to get big enough that I think governments are going to start to add some regulation. You know, maybe we should talk about what that might be. It's hard to say, but they'll add something that kind of forces or incentivizes vendors to pay more attention.
I could see something along the lines of like a standard put out by NIST or something, NIST. Where they have to conform to this certain standard of saying, hey, all right, no backdoors by default. You have to force users to change a password, or something along those lines, where the manufacturers have at least minimum bar to meet, where it might not be totally secure, but at least they've crossed off like the super easy ways.
Or maybe fines on big exploitable vulnerabilities that are found after the fact.
Yep.
I'm curious though, by the way, can you use the carrot instead of the stick? Meaning, rather than having some sort of fine-based thing or regulation that you can't have a backdoor, which, you know, to enforce that you have to have a fine if there is a backdoor, can there be some incentive that if you can prove a certain level of, like if you can prove, if NIST creates an IoT security recommendation paper like they do for Windows and everything else, if you can prove that you comply to that,
you get to put a sticker on your box or something.
You put a sticker on your box, but maybe you get some tax benefit or something like that.
That'd be an interesting way of doing it that I think might work better than simply beating them in the face. Because, I mean, I'm also a realist in that I get that nothing is 100% secure. And so saying that you're going to fine a company if their device is hacked is a bit of a slippery slope, because, I mean, attackers will always find a way. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't still require or at least heavily incentivize companies
there's
to go after the
low hanging fruit. There's some flaws that are negligence that are just so basic that they shouldn't be. There could be some obscure off by one vulnerability in some proprietary software you wrote, we can't really hammer them for that.
But if you leave
that,
open telnet
it,
with admin admin as
exactly,
the credentials.
Which, by the way, was exactly why Mirai spread.
yes.
Or a hard-coded password that you couldn't change that
correct.
Was public. So if you do something as dumb as that, maybe then you can have a little more
yeah.
teeth.
And I could also see maybe even something on the consumer side too, where if you are a administrator or a purchaser of at least certain classes of IoT, maybe you have some responsibility that's backed by regulation to deploy it in a secure manner, because maybe people realize that there isn't a way to entirely secure IoT devices.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see how that develops. I have a feeling that as soon as we get the next big Mirai 2.0 attack, whatever it may be, there's going to be a very rapid period of change in the world of Internet of Things.
So how do you think IoT is going to change in the future? I overgeneralized to explain the problem, saying IoT devices are essentially just computers. They're hardware devices that run software, which is absolutely true. But often there's some specialization to IoT. There are things IoT devices sometimes have, or technologies they use, that aren't in a traditional computer. Thinking of that kind of thing, how do you think IoT is going to continue to change and evolve in the future?
Well, it's really easy for me to rag on IoT as a security professional, because they do have a lot of security flaws. But the reason they're growing, adoption of IoT is growing at such a rapid rate, is because they do provide useful features. The Amazon Echo, for example, I mean, it provides convenience for like getting the weather or your calendar updates or playing your favorite songs or whatever without having to go pull up an app on your phone or physically log into your computer and do stuff. So they provide convenience, which is one of the reasons that they continue to explode, basically. And as we find more ways to connect devices to the internet, to get more data, to provide more usefulness, IoT is going to continue taking off.
I think to find more ways to connect is one of the ways that they'll change in the future. I mean, it's not required for IoT, but almost by definition nowadays, IoT devices are wireless.
Right.
The reason your Siri example is so useful is you don't have to plug it in and set up your, it's just some wireless device. You put it anywhere you want in your house and it just works. And I one of the things we see changing, and I think IoT is driving it more than anything, is different types of wireless protocols. I think the wireless protocol, as nerds like us know, has been continuing to evolve over time, but there's near field community, there's short distance wireless protocols. There's longer wireless distance wireless protocols. There's new protocols that like Zigbee that are defined for lots of little devices in some sort of automation environment, like home automation and
yeah.
stuff.
If you ask a lot of people like what they think of when you say wireless networking, they'll go point at their like Netgear or
yeah.
like router
some
sitting
Wi-Fi
by their TV.
Device.
Wi-Fi, yes. Whereas a lot of these new devices, like the Hue light bulbs that you can plug in, or even like the Ring doorbell, they don't communicate over Wi-Fi. They communicate over separate protocols, which some of these are actually closed protocols, and
yeah.
security professionals can't go in.
Yeah,
and
there's a plus and a minus there. I mean, to
yeah.
your innovation point, I think it's great that there's innovation of this
yeah.
wireless protocol, and it's adding some of the wireless protocols open up new use cases like smart grids and things like that.
Or more efficient methods
yeah.
for communication, less power hungry. But
exactly.
if they're proprietary, if they're closed and people can't review the source code,
yeah.
sometimes there's vulnerabilities, and someone could go find a man-in-the-middle vulnerability, and suddenly they have full control over your lighting system and your door lock, for example.
And I think another way IoT is evolving the future of cybersecurity, and it's evolving, is IoT devices, while they're just computers, they tend to have sensors and gather data that traditional computers never have. I mean, like, a computer has data we type and input, and maybe videos and images and stuff like that. But now we have things measuring the heat of water. We have things measuring our heartbeat. We have things, these sensors that measure all kinds of different stuff, but then connecting it to the internet and pushing it off. And I think that's a lot of, again, the same thing, the innovation thing. But I think what we're getting here is attack surface. All this stuff is really cool from a technologist view, a nerdy person imagining a pretty awesome future with lots of neat things you can do with that big data and with this new capability. But now we have 12 different wireless protocols that might have different security vulnerabilities. So we have new sensors that expose new data that may have new privacy risks or new ways that can be exploited. So I do think IoT's future is bright, but I think we need to realize the biggest security problem we have, I think, in the modern world is the huge complexity of these systems we're creating. And the more devices we connect with the more amounts of sensors and data that's kind of new to the internet, never been seen before, I think it's going to cause some pretty interesting ramifications as much as it does
so innovation. So now that we've painted that very happy and beautiful picture of the future.
Skynet's already here, guys.
What are some takeaways you think we can give to our audience?
Well, a lot. First of all, one I always like to give, and by the way, there's security defenses you can do beyond this, but don't forget, because IoT device is essentially a computer, it can be patched. You know, one of the best things we do with traditional computing systems is we know they have software vulnerabilities, bad configurations, things like that, and good software vendors regularly release patches. A lot of people think of IoT devices as just closed hardware boxes, but they're running a firmware, which is just a fancy name for a kind of a OS running on a closed system type situation. And unfortunately, this doesn't always help you because there's different levels of IoT vendors. Some will actually patch aggressively. They pay attention to security things and they release updates all the time. They have nice automatic update mechanisms.
Some ignore security researchers like me for 3 months straight.
Yeah, some might be a camera in Taiwan that was cobbled together as a clone of something else sold out of some dude's house, and his email address is connected to Gmail. So patching's not going to always save you, but if you're buying kind of the big vendor, the common IoT devices, make sure you patch that device. You know, if the device has automated patching, turn it on. Otherwise, they all have management systems. Go in every once in a while, press the button to look for an update and be sure to patch it.
Yeah. And one of the things I'd like to throw in there as well is, so far still, you cannot consider IoT to be secure. I don't think that we're in a spot right now where we can assume that any IoT device we connect to our network is going to be safe permanently, which means you need to take special care when you go to deploy these devices at home or at work to deploy them in a secured method. Now, most people at home don't go segment their network. I don't even think D-Link, whatever,
can
do that.
That's a device I'm okay giving a security professional running a business network, but that's hard to tell the dude at home with his Xbox and his Siri.
But at least at work, though, if you are going to be plugging in security cameras, or maybe you let the CTO have his Amazon Echo in his office.
Who's that guy?
Or his smart connected 4K 80-inch TV.
My Oculus Go.
Yeah. You do need to deploy these securely. That means put them on their own separate network where you can not only keep them from communicating with other devices on your main network, but monitor what they do communicate with. That way you can hopefully catch if something fishy is going
on. By the way, the reason this advice is hard to give for normal consumers, if you don't know, is segmenting your network. What we mean is put your IoT devices on a totally different network than your normal computers. And that way, if they ever get hacked, there's some additional security hoops that bad guys have to jump to get to your crown jewels. The problem with giving that advice is the benefit of IoT is it just works. I can plug into this device and then my iPhone can access and manage it. But my iPhone or my computer accessing and managing it means there's some sort of communication protocol.
One of the biggest issues with consumer IoT.
So the problem with segmentation is when you segment it, you then have to go through and create very specific policies, which are going to be different for every IoT device that only allow the communication necessary for your normal computers to do whatever to connect to that IoT device and let it do whatever it does, whether it be printing or show you video from a webcam. So it means you have to know what you're doing. You have to not only segment it, but make a lot of policies to allow what you want so that the IoT device works. But you also get to follow the least privilege principle, which means you're not allowing everything else like that telnet that would maybe let stuff in. By the way, the one thing we've failed to say right away is firewall these IoT. Besides segmenting them, just don't just put them on the public internet like we have found many webcams to be. you know, segment them. I mean, put them behind a firewall. If they happen to have a telnet service running, as some apparently do, oh my gosh, at least the firewall will prevent that.
And those that may not be familiar with networking technology or terminology, but have heard the term port forwarding, if your IoT device asks you to port forward inbound traffic to it, second guess that unless it's absolutely required, because that is the easiest way for an attacker to get in and add your camera or teddy bear or whatever to their botnet.
I got to say, one of the challenges to IoT, and I don't know how to solve it, is I do say firewall it, which will help with telnet and stuff, but there's also these kind of protocol. IoT is all about plugging it in and it just works. Mm-hmm. And as any security person knows, you can make inside out connections too that are two ways. So a lot of IoT devices do make outside, like, encrypted connections to clouds, but sometimes they might have a two-way thing, so they're technically sneaking past your firewall. That's kind of harder, you know, that's proprietary, that depends on the device. But you should, what I'm getting at is, if you are a more technical person, learn how your IoT device connects with the cloud. Learn how it communicates externally and make sure that does not become an attack vector for you.
And if you're not a more technical person, just enjoy it while you can until Skynet takes over.
Yeah. Leave it open for me and we'll come explore your network.
I need more cryptocurrency. Let's add them.
Yeah. Need to up my Bitcoin miners. Cool. Well, anything else? Do you think we covered all of it for what to do?
Probably not, but hopefully that's enough for now. That's it for this episode. If you like the podcast, please rate and review us. You can always find me and Corey on Twitter. I'm at @XORRO_ and Corey is at @SecAdept. Let us know if you have any questions or topic recommendations. If you need a daily fix of security news, insights, videos, or in-depth research, go to secplicity.org. Up next, we'll have two special editions. The first is a short Q&A between Corey and me. You'll learn all about our origins, including Corey's first hack and my first near electrocution. Thanks again for listening. See you later.